Thanks for listening to the Mornings with Carmen LaBurge podcast, made available thanks to support from listeners just like you.
Your daily encouragement that God has the world in the hollow of his hand. This is Mornings with Carmen LaBurge on Faith Radio.
If we're gonna fly, we fly like eagles.
Again, this is Mornings Without Carmen. I'm Paul. Good Wednesday morning. Thanks for listening to Faith Radio. You know, when you go out in the world living out your faith and you rub shoulders with others, sometimes things rub the wrong way and conflicts arise. Sometimes they're big. I was at Christianity Today yesterday and I saw an article about what's happening in Nicaragua. I mean, remember last year, August and September, they got hit by a couple of major hurricanes, Hillary and Idalia. And evangelical ministries down there and Catholic Christian ministries had no option other than to step up and serve. You see, President Daniel Ortega and his wife, who's the vice president, had expelled the Red Cross from the country that previous July after they criticized the organization criticized the country for their inhumane treatment of prisoners. And that departure left a huge humanitarian aid gap for that country. One of those ministry organizations is called Mountain Gateway. The American Missions and Development Agency was one of many that helped organize major, not only evangelism, but relief efforts in that country, where pastors and church leaders shared the gospel to thousands who were receiving food, clothing, and medicine in the wake of those hurricanes. The event they had was called Buenos Nueves Nicaragua, or Good News Nicaragua. And that united more than 1,300 churches from 13 of Nicaragua's 15 regions in a massive two-day evangelistic event in the capital, Managua, this past November. Local news estimated that up to 300,000 people attended the gathering. And despite the ongoing tensions between Ortega's administration and churches, but the gathering's success in sharing spiritual encouragement as well as practical provisions in a time of need ultimately had little effect on softening the government's latest crusade against Christian ministries. Since 2018, the Ortega administration has imprisoned and exiled numerous Catholic priests who have criticized the regime, but as the population of Nicaragua has grown more evangelical, so has the persecution of evangelical churches. A report recently published by the Christian Solidarity Worldwide registered 310 severe violations of freedom of religion or belief between November of 2022 and January of this year, according to Nicaragua Nuncia Mas, which since 2018, the government has closed like 256 evangelical organizations. Weeks after the Buenos Nueves Nicaragua event, the government ordered the closure of Mountain Gateway's 10 churches and arrested 11 of their pastors. Nicaraguan authorities have cited this reason numerous times in the past, saying there's money laundering going on. Since 2018, it has closed almost 3,400 non-governmental organizations, 10% of them foreign, for that cause, claiming money laundering, according to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Even with increased persecution and false accusations, many local Protestant pastors and foreign ministry leaders have largely chosen to keep quiet, but it's getting harder for them to do so. In 2023, they ranked them number 50 in the annual list of dangerous countries. As of last year, Nicaragua is now 30. It's unfortunately going up the charts. Again, Christians going out there trying to serve the people, yes, proclaiming the good news of Jesus and practically loving as well. And they're rubbing shoulders with people and unfortunately rubbing some people the wrong way. In about 25 minutes, I hope to be talking with Demem Nolist, who has long thought about this. He's a Haitian Christian, now lives in the U.S. He teaches at Denver Seminary. And he's thought about, okay, how do we engage well, especially in situations like this? But how do we engage well, even in our own country here? How do we engage well for the gospel and for the kingdom? First, though, as again we continue here on Mornings with Carmen, we're going to turn our attention to the world of science. As a matter of fact, and I just saw it this morning, the Intuitive Machines Odysseus lander, which landed over the weekend, has stopped transmitting several days earlier than intended. What's happening? Well, we're going to talk science with Heather Zeiger. She is a science writer and a research analyst for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. We'll talk about that and so much more as we continue this morning here on Mornings with Carmen on Faith Radio. All is God's creation, and it's fun to look at it, especially with an eye to try and understand it better, and that's why science exists, and that's why we like talking with Heather Zeiger here on Mornings with Carmen on Faith Radio. I'm Paul. Heather, thank you for joining us again. And okay, I was excited this weekend when I heard about the landing of the Odysseus lunar lander, but things have not gone as well. Now, what is the Odysseus lander?
Yeah, so this is actually the first U.S. spacecraft to land on the moon in more than 50 years.
Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting. And it did land on the moon, and it landed within a mile of its intended target, even when there was a little bit of there was a communication gap there during the landing. So they had to do it by hand, if you will, not
okay.
really, but they had to. So there was some issues there with the landing, and yet it still landed within its target around the South Pole. Unfortunately, it fell over. So one of its legs got caught in a part of the crater, and the moon lander, Odysseus, or what they nicknamed it Odie, fell over. And so that means that some of its antennae are not pointing upwards. So that's where we had some communication problems. And if you read some of the articles, they say, well, it was pretty exciting there because like they weren't contacting it and then they were. This also means that the solar panels aren't pointed towards the sun and it's not getting enough energy. So it was meant to do some studies, do some experiments for, I think, a little over a week, and they're going to have to cut that a few days short.
Mm-hmm.
Because it fell over.
Now, they have some other ones planned, don't they? Some other landers?
Yes, I think this is part of the Artemis program. So this is the idea is to do some is to have some other landing on the moon. And of course, a lot of these countries are interested in the South Pole because there's like water deposits there, and they're interested in like heavy hydrogen and heavy water there. And then eventually to have another manned moon landing.
When is that scheduled? Because I know they're talking about it. They had it roughly scheduled.
Oh, boy. I'm trying to remember what I last read versus if that timeline has changed. But I think they were looking at 2026.
Hmm. That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I love space exploration. Too much time watching Star Trek and such, so I guess. But anyway.
Same here.
All right. Well, one of the big bits of news that happened over the last week or so came out of Alabama, where the Supreme Court in that state basically upheld the human life, the human value of the unborn, actually in this case, embryo that's frozen, an IVF frozen baby that was, okay, somebody broke into one of the places where they were stored and destroyed some embryos. And the parents of some of the parents basically sued under the idea that this was manslaughter. And anyway, that's leading to a lot of discussion right now.
Yeah, so this is kind of the big bioethics topic. So the case says that the law in Alabama, the case was looking at the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and that applies. They decided that applies to all unborn children, no matter the location. Which then the court said, this also applies to extrauterine embryos, so embryos that have not been implanted in the case of IVF. So the big issue here, and Paul, I want to be totally sensitive to the fact that people with unwanted children, you know, this is a very delicate issue. So
yeah.
I really want to be sensitive to the fact that, you know, Proverbs 13:12 talks about, you know, a hope deferred makes the heart sick. So this is a kind of pain that, you know, we always want to tread carefully here. But having said that, the big issue here is that IVF, as it is currently practiced, requires the destruction of embryos.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't to say that every assisted reproductive technology destroys embryos, but IVF does. That is the most popular. This is the one that is, you know, the billion-dollar industry. Something like 400,000 children a year are born through IVF, and that's globally. So this poses a problem if these embryos, so if this is a technique where embryos are destroyed, and this is a technique that creates embryos, excess embryos that are frozen, then we have some ethical issues here. Having said that, we're not totally flying blind here. The company the Bioethics Center I work with, the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, on their homepage, they have posted some of our resources that I think people would really appreciate. Just, we have some good writers who have dealt with this topic very sensitively, looking at, well, what do we do about excess frozen embryos? I'll give you just a quick kind of ethics issues, and we'll start with language. So this is something that I, as a writer, really care about. Mm-hmm. IVF does not cure infertility. Infertility is a medical condition that leads to childlessness. IVF addresses childlessness. Mm. So we want to be careful about that, because in most cases, the couple is still by definition infertile after IVF. And so you'll see this kind of conflation of these medical terms here. And so we want to be careful how we talk about that. So what that means is, if the couple is still infertile even after IVF, that means that if they want to have another child, they still need to do another round of IVF.
Right.
So that's why oftentimes, to save money, because it's hugely expensive, they will make lots of embryos in the event that the couple wants to have more children or the procedure doesn't work. So to deal with a technique, sometimes those embryos that are discarded would have never been viable. So the fertilization did not occur correctly. But in other cases, they would have become children under the right conditions. And we know that because of, you know, people trying it out, which are experiments that I wouldn't necessarily say are ethical. But then it ends up that these embryos that would have been discarded can grow into perfectly normal, healthy babies. So what we're seeing is that these embryos are thrown out because they don't have the features that make the technique itself work. Mm. So that's an issue. We also need to be aware of something. And, you know, I've known people who have used IVF, and they would agree with this, that the reproductive industry is a billion-dollar industry that sometimes preys upon vulnerable people. Okay, because obviously people are going in and they are upset. This is a vulnerable situation, and this industry is kind of sometimes preys on vulnerable people.
Right.
Not only that, the U.S. has some of the fewest regulations of any country in the world, which is why we kind of get the nefarious title of Wild West of reproductive technologies. And that's where frozen embryos come in. The fact that there are so many embryos in cold storage, something like a million embryos, is one of the results of this.
Other countries have stricter ones. For example, you know, what do some of the other countries do to limit the human toll, if you wish?
Yeah, so some countries only require you to implant all of the embryos that you create. So you can't create more than what you plan to implant. Some countries, and I think France is one of them, you are only allowed to implant one embryo at a time, because there were times when people would implant more than one and you would have births of twins or triplets. And of course, anyone who's had natural twin or triplet births knows that you are automatically put in high risk pregnancy once it's multiples. So you don't want to put mothers under high risk pregnancy, and also the children tend to be born prematurely. So there's different regulations like that. And since you're not allowed to create as many embryos, not every place has cold storage like the United States does. So there are various rules in various countries. And then that leads to the very tricky ethical question of, what do you do about the frozen embryos? And the truth is, Paul, there is not a great solution.
No, there isn't.
My colleague, Brian Just at CBHD, has a good article on our website on what to do with the unchosen frozen. He wrote it for Salvo Magazine. And, you know, even embryo adoption, which many Christians like that idea, there's still some criticisms about that. So this is the idea that someone decides to gestate a they adopt an embryo and then they have it implanted and they gestate it and that embryo is their child. So adoption is biblical, but it's also, there's some criticisms to this because you're still giving money to an industry that created the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but the two major companies that have helped with the embryo adoption, I think maybe they have helped about, they have done over 150 pregnancies a year sometimes, and we're talking 0.21% of frozen embryos. Mm-hmm. The math just doesn't even add up that there's enough people or parents for the frozen embryos we have.
Yeah.
So, and every other solution other than transferring to the parent that created the embryo, every other solution is morally problematic. And even that one, transferring, I mean, there are some parents that for health reasons cannot carry another child or don't have the financial means to do so. So this is one of those ethical conundrums where I'm like, we've really gotten ourselves in a situation here.
That's really the point. I mean, the more we try and push things, and again, it's an industry, they're looking at profit and such, that really the humanity gets, all humanity, not only the child, but the parents, you name it, it's just kind of lost. We've created our own nightmare, it seems.
Yeah. And, you know, as well-intended as it might have been 40 some odd years ago, we have created a problem. The frozen embryo situation, some of that has to do with cost. That has to do with success rates, things like that, things that really just make it sound like you're commodifying children.
Yeah, that's the concern. And they are, well, created in the image of God. I'm glad, you know, you were talking about some of the ministries that do snowflake babies, as some people call them. Well, I appreciate them, and it has touched many families. It's still, yeah, there's issues around that too, but... Well, as we continue here on Mornings with Carmen and continue talking with Heather Zeiger, I saw this yesterday that just kind of jumped out at me. Would you like to have AI reproduce a loved one who has passed away based upon, you know, your text messages, social media posts and such? Basically, the term resurrection was used in this. So when we talk resurrection, That's a big spiritual term, and we need to talk about this in just a few moments with Heather Zeiger again with the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. We'll continue in just a moment here on Faith Radio.
You are not alone. Do you believe me when I say that? You are not alone. The enemy wants you to believe that you are not only alone, all alone, but to make you feel bad about it. That's loneliness. And it's a lie. Jesus tells us that the enemy tells us lies to rob us of our joy, kill our hope, and destroy our lives. And so if you're experiencing loneliness today, let me say this. You're not alone. The enemy is using the weapon of loneliness against a lot of people right now. But here's the good news. God is present. God is present right now, and he's closer to you than your very next breath. God loves you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. You were created for relationship with him. And that sense of loneliness that you have right now, well, that's an indication that your heart knows it. Loneliness is the spiritual indicator that real love, real companionship, real relationship, real life are all possible. And guess what? Jesus literally came to make that connection with you. Do you want to know more? Text the word LONELY to 877-933-2484. And I'll drop in on you to remind you that God is present and you're not alone. Text LONELY, L-O-N-E-L-Y, to 877-933-2484. Connecting faith to life, Faith Radio.
Okay, AI can do amazing things. There's been... AI is doing impersonations of people, or at least redoing their voice for commercials. Or, okay, if you ever watch any new, and I mentioned Star Wars earlier, there's any new Star Wars movies that have Darth Vader, even though, and don't worry, he's okay with this. James Earl Jones was okay with them continuing to use his voice, but an AI generator is doing that, not him. He's retired. He's retired. Okay, that's one thing, but AI posing as a loved one who has passed? Yeah, there's talk about that too. And Heather Zeiger, who's joining us now from the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, there's a lot of angles on this one from both theological and just an ethical standpoint.
Yeah, and I want to say that there was an article in Vox, of all places, not too long ago, where the author did a great job of explaining how much religious language is used to describe AI in Silicon Valley. So that was a little while ago, but that was a good article. And here you're seeing it again, where it's the idea of using AI chatbots like ChatGPT to quote unquote resurrect a loved one. And you know, maybe you can do some things with some video and such, but what they're really looking at is training a chatbot on your loved one's text messages, social media posts, and any other kind of writing. So then the algorithm kind of learns how to mimic the person who has died. In other words, what would the person likely say? So then you can ask your deceased father for advice on what on some issue, or you can ask your mother what she would have thought of your new job. So you get to converse with a deceased loved one, but you're really conversing with a chatbot. So one of the issues is, and I've seen this in a couple of places actually, that this can cause some mental health issues, which I kind of feel like is a little bit obvious here. You know, some people think, oh, this might help you cope, but actually I think that some people say this might stall the grieving process.
Yeah.
So grief isn't, grief is not linear. You know, I know we like to think about stages of grief and we're a very analytical society, but grief is not linear. You know, you have good days, you have bad days, but it is still a kind of process, and it's important for all of us to go through that process because it kind of provides a mental closure. That's why we have funerals. That's why we have memorials, why we remember these things. And so to have a chatbot that you're talking to as if it was your loved one, but it isn't, it's an algorithm. This, I think people are concerned about the mental health fallout from that.
Yeah. This has to go with part of our culture where we have a hard time, the idea of lamenting and mourning something.
Yeah.
And this doesn't solve the problem. It only hides it and the need.
Yeah.
So, but even beyond that, let's look at this. I mean, you're a Christian. You look at this theologically, and I understand why some people might get involved. But as Christians who have our hope in the gospel and of the coming kingdom, when we will be reunited with loved ones who are believers, this almost seems out of place. Well, it does.
Well, it seems like a kind of technological man-made version to address something that we deeply desire. You know, we have eternity in our hearts, but this is like a poor replacement for, I mean, we're going to celebrate Easter here in a few weeks. So this is like a poor replacement for what we hope to celebrate in Easter. So for the bodily resurrection.
It does.
So, I mean, and you have to say, though, that this is addressing a very real desire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, death is not, like some people like to say, death is natural. It isn't natural in the sense of like we're both part of creation, but we're also in the image of God. So
right.
death was a result of the fall. Mm-hmm. So it is okay to lament it, even as Christians, to grieve the fact that we are experiencing the effects of the fall.
But then we also hope in the resurrection. That's something. I mean, the whole idea is having the connection with people too, because we're made as relational beings. We have this connection with each other, and it hurts when that connection's broken, especially by that. But we do look forward to the time when the reconnection will actually be better than anything we had here on Earth. That's the thing. So this is, again, it's just kind of a sad, I wouldn't even call it substitute, but something false, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have just a few more minutes, Heather, and okay, here it is. Well, almost spring. I mean, Friday is the start of meteorological spring, theoretically, or at least what meteorologists do. They start at the beginning of the month, not when the solstice or equinox happens. But we are getting to that season where bugs get out there. They're flying around and you're trying to have a nice time outside in the evening and you have a little light going and the bugs are flying around it. And there's been a lot of debate. Why do bugs like to fly around the campfires, the candles, the, okay, maybe you like putting up the bug zapper and such, but they think, scientists think they finally found out why bugs fly around lights.
Yes. So I always thought they were attracted to the light.
Yeah,
and it turns
me
out
too.
That's not the case. So there was a study that looked at insect movement using motion sensors and slow motion cameras. And it turns out many of these flying insects, a lot of flying insects actually, so this is really cool, they have an internal navigation system. And the bugs instinctively keep the brightest light, their back towards the brightest light. So I say overhead, but it's really their back. So this is called dorsal light response, and it's an instinctive thing in flying insects. So these flying insects tilt their backs towards the brightest light in the sky because that tells them, that orients them to which way is up. Or at least it would if the brightest light in the sky was the sun. So we have electrical lights now. So when the brightest light is a porch light or a street light, then the bugs get confused. They instinctively want to keep their backs towards the light. So they think they're flying in a straight line. And what they end up doing is they end up flying in circles because they think they're keeping the brightest light overhead and they think they're flying in a straight line, but they're actually caught in this kind of doom loop circle until something like wind dislodges them. So something else they found out was the most confusing light position for bugs is when a light is shining upwards from the ground. Some insects will actually literally turn themselves upside down and like crash land into the ground and things like that.
So what you're saying is we're messing with it. It's not they're messing with us. We've been messing with them all this time.
Yes. That is what I'm saying.
Well, now we know the rest of the story. Heather, thank you so much for joining us today here on Faith Radio.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Paul.
Yeah, it is. Heather Zeiger, again, check her out at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. You can check that out at cbhd.org. Also, she edits, she's an editor for bioethics.com, where she covers stuff like we did with the stuff around in vitro fertilization, if you want more information, and of course, at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity as well. I'm Paul. This is Mornings with Carmen here on Faith Radio. And okay, have you ever been on a missions trip to Haiti? I know many have. Maybe you've supported a ministry working in that country. Well, over the last more than 50 years, Haiti has received more Christian missions and humanitarian attention than from the U.S. than probably any nation. And yet, if you look at it now, it is a nation overrun by corruption and gangs. Many call it a failed state, and its people continue to suffer greatly. Now, there are many factors to this, the difficult state of affairs in that country, but have Christians, in spite of our good intentions, been part of that failure? How should we engage, not in countries like that, but even in our own country, in our states, in our communities, to help bring flourishing and point people to Jesus and his coming kingdom? That's the question we hope to talk to, and I hope I get the name right, Demem Nolist. He is a professor at Denver Seminary, and also he is the author of a book that I read last year that I fell in love with called Authentic Engagement. Demem joins me in 3 minutes here on Mornings with Carmen on Faith Radio. Well, again, thank you for listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul, filling in for Carmen this week, helping you apply the mind of Christ to the matters of the day. And we're trying to do that because we want you to engage well. Now, when you're watching the news and you see such deep problems in the world and in their nation, and actually the posture some people take amidst these conflicts, how do you react? Maybe you're just one. You see the news, you see what's happening, you read the headlines, you see what's happening politically, all that other stuff, and you just want to say, no. I just want to turn my back and just do my Christian thing. Others want to be culture warriors and go in there and fight. But is there another way? Is there a biblical way? After reading a book last year, I think there is. The book I read was Authentic Engagement, The Role of the Church in Social Transformation. And Demem Nolist is the author, and he joins me now here on Mornings with Carmen. Demem, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you. Now, originally, you're from Haiti, and I was talking a little while ago about Haiti and how after so many years of getting, you know, gospel help as well as humanitarian help, much of it Christian, it still struggles. I want you to share about your homeland. And
Yes.
Go ahead. I mean, I want your perspective. I mean, I'm seeing my perspective. What do you see? Because it's your homeland.
Yes, it is. It is my homeland, and you can imagine I ache when I see what is happening in that land, particularly in the last, 25, 30 years, things to seem to have deteriorated, and the land I grew up with was a very sweet piece of real estate. We were not wealthy, but life wasn't all impossible as it is right now. I grew up with a family. My mother was a widow, and four of us. And then we managed and went to school, and we were able to go about. But things have changed very, very sour in recent times. And at the moment, as people have been following the news, everything is kind of brought to a halt because of insecurity, because numbers of gangs, particularly in the city of Port-au-Prince, makes movement in the city impossible, and people cannot go about the activities, the schools and business. Everything is really brought to a halt, and that really makes life tough.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the country and I know of so many ministry organizations that have been involved there. There's the church there in the nation as well that's been trying to do good or trying. And yet, how do you sense? Tell me how you saw the church and Christians engaging in that country, what various ways you saw that happening to try and bring help.
Yes. Let me begin by saying that in the midst of the troubles I talked about, the church is strong. The church is strong. Christianity is growing. It's, according to statistics, it's reached the neighborhood of 50% of the population. This is incredible. That was going on. Yes, historically, the church used to be, and talk about that in the book, used to be, you know, we don't want to get involved in things political and kind of an understanding of the faith that truncated the gospel. Things began to change. I was in Haiti just in December, and I took part in a conference, the aim of which is to challenge the church leaders to take the well-being of this city seriously. Mm-hmm. And they came from all over the southern peninsula of Haiti. I spoke to a crowd about, let's say, 300. And the interest in this, I just shared some of the things I said within the book, and that gave me joy. That gave me hope, because as long as the Church of God is there and is open to receive the challenge that God has given it to it in its word, as with respect to its mission in the world, mm-hmm. I don't lose hope.
That's good. Well, the book you're talking about is Authentic Engagement, The Role of the Church in Social Transformation. And when it comes to our posture, I like the word posture as part of Christians. You were talking there, so many ministries just kind of had this non-engagement with culture. We just do our evangelism, we do that, but don't think about the broader thing of the culture around us. And that didn't work. And then you have other countries, other places where people want to have this full-throated, thoroughgoing engagement. It's kind of the culture warrior kind of thing, and oftentimes tying your you're hitching your wagon, as it were, to some sort of political movement, which also has this problem. But I kind of gave away two of them. In the book, you outline, first off, four different methods or postures Christians have taken historically when it comes to engaging the issues around us. Could you quickly summarize those? You already mentioned the non-engagement. What about the others?
Yes. So you have what I call the indirect engagement.
Okay.
Where we say, okay, the church's role is to preach the gospel and then bring as many people as possible. And those of those that it brings to its fold, there may be some who are called to engage in to have a ministry of engagement, and through them, the church will achieve its missions of engagement.
Right.
That is what I call the indirect engagement. The other one is kind of partial engagement, which says yes. We can be involved, but there are certain limits or there are certain spheres of reality that we dare not touch because they're kind of the two kingdoms understanding of Christian faith that Martin Luther mentioned centuries ago. And then you have the thoroughgoing engagement, unbridled engagement, which says that nothing is off limit when it comes to changing society. We must do everything, and the church must pretty much engage in the battle, unmindful of its own integrity and identity. Mm. And I find all of them faulty, because I think either they are too timid in terms of engagement, or they are simply too, I would say, careless.
Well, you brought up the idea of identity here, because our identity as the church is part of what's at issue here.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you offer, again, by the title of your book, Authentic Engagement, a different view, a different posture. And we'll have to break here in a few moments, but I want to start by talking about why you call this authentic.
Yes. I call it authentic because I want it to be real, to be serious about challenging the context, but to do so in a way that doesn't impugn the integrity of the church itself. As I read the book, I talk about the church as the people of God, as having a connection with God. And I take this identity seriously, and everything that we do must be careful not to damage that integrity. We must engage the world with credibility. And I see the church as a prophet, frankly, discharging a prophetic role. If the prophet loses his integrity, his respect, his moral standing, then the message that it gives or that he gives will not be received, or he will be brought aside as somebody who loses credibility. Mm-hmm. So authentic engagement is serious engagement, as I call it, but engagement within bounds. Within bounds.
Right. You use the term unbridled. There is a bridle in this case, and that is the gospel and the nature of the kingdom, which we'll get to in just a few moments. We have to take a brief break, ma'am. But when we continue, let's unpack this authentic engagement a bit more. Again, you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul, and talking with Demen Nolis, the author of the book Authentic Engagement, The Role of the Church in Social Transformation. We'll continue in a moment here on Faith Radio.
If you're a new listener, we want to officially welcome you with a free welcome pack gift. Request yours today at myfaithradio.com.
Well, again, thank you for listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul, filling in and talking with Dememnolis, who is a theologian over at Denver Seminary and the author of the book Authentic Engagement. And as we look at how we engage the world around us, whether it be political engagement or you name it, business, any aspect of your life when you're engaging, how are you doing it? Do you have actually a tendency to non-engage, kind of hide, or do you want to be kind of that thoroughgoing, really heavily engaged and not thinking, unbridled engagement, not really thinking about, well, your witness and also who you're part of? And that's kind of the big issue here, Demem, because as we're talking with authentic engagement, we are called to be the people of God. And with authentic engagement, your idea, you're basing it, well, first and foremost, on the very nature of God himself as a triune being.
Yes, as a triune God. The God who exists in community of the three persons and who is interested in what is happening in the world that he has created.
Right.
And who intervenes to redemptively in this world and who has not left the world without a witness. And the witness that he has placed in this world is his people, his church, and who a people who has a connection with him. It's not just a people who exist on its own, but a people who is connected to the triune God himself.
Right. And which makes us, in a sense, we're brought into his kingdom through the gospel. Which makes us, and we're looking forward to the coming kingdom, right? There's an eschatological aspect to this. We're looking toward the future and looking toward when God makes all things new, redeems all things, renews all things. And that kind of, this wonderful wholeness, the shalom will be there.
Correct.
And as ambassadors of that, ambassadors of that here in the world today, then that means we should, in all our engagements, political, business, family, whatever, we should be bringing that back with us here, right? We're ambassadors.
Correct. And I use the language of ambassador to really speak of the church. In the theology of the church that I try to present very briefly in the book, I call it ambassador of heaven.
Yeah.
That's what we are. And I speak of the fact that every local church, wherever it is located, must be conscious of the fact that it is a representative of the triune God in that environment. And as a representative of a triune God, just as the ambassador of a country has a message, the message of the leader of that country that he or she represents, the church, wherever it is, has that message, has that lifestyle, has that way of looking at the world that is reflective of the way that God looks at the world. And its role in that corner of the world is to make that message evident and that lifestyle evident, and to tell the people in that corner, there is a better way. There is another regime that means good for you, and to encourage people to embrace that regime, the regime of God, and to order their lives according to it.
Yeah. Ordering our lives according to this. Do we actually trust that that is the beautiful thing ourselves sometimes, right?
Yes. Well, obviously, this is where the way the people of God order lives is as more powerful as what they say.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say that, well, it is a great thing, but it's another thing to let people see it as a great thing.
And
therefore to want to have it.
Right. Okay, I want to put some some practical feet to this. For example, how do you, you said you were down in Haiti talking with some church leaders down there around these ideas, because you saw ministries that kind of, okay, we're just doing our own little thing and not worry about what's happening around us, the people we're meant to serve and love. What did you encourage them to do practically in Haiti to hopefully bring transformation to that country?
Yes, I don't know if you remember, after the earthquake of 2010, some of us Haitians living in the United States and were very concerned. So we went to Haiti and we launched a movement called the prophetic movement to encourage the church to engage in the transformation of the society itself. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that in the introduction of the book. And then out of that, to make a long story short, of that movement, for about 5 years, we engaged in attacking some of the problems that are endemic in the country, such as the problem of injustice, lack of justice. And there is, and people don't do it with impunity. People do whatever they want to do. And the question of integrity and the environment. So what we did, we organized conferences and we did theological analysis of this theme. And we bring people by the hundreds to present to them the biblical view of these things and contrasting them with what is happening in the context. I remember after I spoke, one person says, you make us see Haiti as it is in light of the word of God, and we are challenged to do that. For some time, the movement did not discontinue. When I went to Haiti in December with my good friend, Edouard Lasseg, who was for Compassion International, we relaunched the movement and presenting the same idea that, listen, what exists, you have to, as the people of God, you have to be attentive to the well-being of the city. Whether it is the trash in the street, you may not be able to do a lot of things, but big things, so to speak. But you can be involved in saying things can be better and to mobilize people, the people in the congregation, to be involved in making that street on which they live a better street. And so that the people can see the gospel in action. And of course, give other examples of how they can be involved in making lives in their particular neighborhood better.
Right. You bring about the beauty. It's actually funny you mentioned the garbage thing, because Carmen, who is the regular host, was talking some time ago about how, even, you know, you're walking along the street, you see a piece of garbage. It's actually a gospel act to clean it up and put it in the it just shows you want beauty, you want clean, you want order, you want wholeness, you want, you know, the peace of the city.
Correct.
So, yeah. Hey, I wish we had more time to talk to Mem, but thank you for joining us today here on Mornings with Carmen. Again, if people want to check out the book, it's called Authentic Engagement, The Role of the Church in Social Transformation. Mem, you and your wife did a great work in this book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Actually, it's not my wife, it's my niece.
Oh, your niece. I'm sorry.
It's my mother. I try, you know, she's a wonderful theologian in her own right.
Oh, there you go.
And so doing a PhD at Dallas.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. So again. Yeah. Thanks again to Mem. We're out of time. But again, thanks for joining us today here on Mornings with Carmen. Well, if you'd like to hear this show again or share it, remember the podcasts are available at myfaithradio.com as well as wherever you get your podcasts on the Faith Radio app. They're there as well. And if you get them, say, like on, you know, Google or Spotify or whatever, rate Mornings with Carmen, would you? Thank you for listening today to Mornings with Carmen on Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening to Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Podcasts like this are available because of your support. If it's important to you to hear things that encourage your faith, click the link in the show notes to give now. And thanks.